Welcome to Sed Contra, a podcast of the Sacra Doctrina Project. I'm Father Dylan Schrader, a pastor of St. Brendan's in Mexico, Missouri. With me are Dr. William Diem.
Glad to be here.
And Dr. Taylor Patrick O'Neill.
Hello, good to be here.
Our topic this evening is predestination, and it should be a great discussion. Before we launch into that, we have a few words about our upcoming conference and also about our new phone number where you can call in and ask questions. So Taylor can give us the details on that.
Yeah. So we just released our call for papers for a conference, Sacra Doctrina Project's first conference. It's going to be held in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, at Mount Mercy University. It's taking place June 18th, 19th, and 20th, this upcoming summer, 2020. And the topic of the conference is the development of doctrine. So, we are accepting abstracts. You can send those into sacradoctrinaproject@gmail.com. And we're looking for 300-word abstracts, roughly, and those will be due on January 15th, and we'll have some more information as we get closer to that date about registration and things like that. But hopefully, looking forward to abstracts and learning and just having a good time.
Excellent. Thank you. And the phone number where our listeners can now call in and ask follow-up questions based on our podcasts.
Yeah, so we had some interaction on social media. A few people had asked if there was a way to send in questions about previous episodes. And so we set up a Google Voice number. So if you call this number, it'll ring, and then it'll just give you an opportunity to leave a voicemail. And we can get that and then download it and play it on the episode and give a response to your question. You can always send us an email as well if you don't want to leave a voicemail, but this is a good option. So the number is 319-382-0886. 319-382-0886.
Wonderful. We hope you do call in. As I said, our topic tonight is predestination. Some folks might be surprised to learn that the Catholic Church does believe in predestination. St. Paul uses the term in his letters, and St. Augustine, St. Thomas also speak of God's effective choice of those who are actually saved. In fact, the next time you're at Mass, if you pay attention to the Eucharistic prayer, you may hear a reference to the elect and our prayers that God might mercifully consider counting us among the elect. Those are the saints in heaven, those who actually are saved by the grace of God and by their own cooperation with that grace. However, there is and has been great controversy within Catholic theology about the mechanism of predestination. How is it that those who are saved by the grace of God? And yet also we have the ability in some way to resist that grace or not to cooperate with it. In short, God must get all the credit for all good and yet not be responsible for evil, which comes from human will alone. How to explain that has been the topic of great controversy, famously a centuries-long debate between the Dominicans and the Jesuits, represented by Domingo Báñez and Luis de Molina. But also some various other nuances and developments in alternative positions as well. Taylor has recently written a book on the subject, so if you wouldn't mind perhaps just telling us what your position is or some of the topics that you treat in that book.
Yeah, sure. So this book is called Grace, Predestination, and the Permission of Sin, a Thomistic Analysis. It's coming out, well, by the time this is out, it should be out, available from CUA Press. And what I do is I go through St. Thomas and I go through Báñez and then through some of the major voices in the 20th century who disagreed on this issue and take a look at their different interpretations of what St. Thomas really teaches about predestination, how it works, how God is related to sin, if at all, how God relates to our freedom. And so, with some nuances of looking at Banez and Gergou Lagrange and some others, I take generally the Banezian position, which I suppose, should I give a short précis on that, or what should I? Okay. I'll point out just briefly that I do think that Molinism and Banezianism agree on a certain point, which is some of our listeners may be familiar with philosophers like Alvin Plantinga or Bruce Reichenbach, tend to be more Protestant philosophers or theologians who say that essentially human freedom is needs to be a complete libertarian view of human freedom, that God doesn't really providentially order what happens in the universe, and God is kind of constantly learning by observing what we do in the universe. Anything else would take away our freedom. Banez and Molina both disagree with that. The question is, how does God providentially govern our acts and have them remain free? Banez's position is that God can, and I think this is also St. Thomas's position, God can and does move us to will things freely, that divine aid and grace effect in us free movements toward the good. And this is not God forcing us to do something, but God moving us to freely choose to do some good. So human freedom is retained and the divine providence is retained. So God is not passive to what we do, sort of sitting around waiting, seeing what we're going to do. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but I think as a sort of very short little précis, that's the kind of the Banezian position. And he calls it physical premotion, God moving us to do good.
Excellent. And William, would you be able to give a summary of the Molinist position?
I will do my best. I want to start with the disclaimer that I'm not committed to the Molinist position. I'm not so much positively in
favor of Molinism. You're not a Molinist, but you play one on TV.
Well, exactly. Or on podcasts.
Yeah.
At some point, I hope the conversation loops back around to Aquinas. And what he does and doesn't say. So anyway, with that disclaimer having been made, I also want to reiterate what Taylor said, that there's a tremendous amount of agreement between the two sides in this debate. Everybody agrees that God knows everything. Not only possible things, but actual things. Everybody agrees that that God is not affected by his creatures or affected by his creatures. He is pure act, right? He's not being influenced by us. And so however God knows our acts, it's not the way we know each other's acts. So there's agreement on that. And there's agreement on meticulous providence, right? That providence isn't just an infinite set of contingency plans. God isn't surprised when Adam decides to eat from the tree. He wasn't sitting there wondering whether Mary was going to give her fiat. All of this had been planned out, logically prior to his choice to create, right? He knew how this was going to play out from the beginning. And he willed to create that world. So there's this idea of meticulous providence and governance, right? Everything's taking place according to the divine will, at least the divine permissive will. There's a lot more agreement there, but I think those are the main sort of fixed points that everybody's working within. So then the Molinists try to solve this conundrum, right? Because the conundrum comes down to, in some sense, how can God, on the one hand, know what we do, know what we have done, know what we will do? This is the problem of foreknowledge. If our choices are free, and if our choices are not changing something in Him, and so that's, I think, the basic problem that ever, that's one of the basic problems. There are a lot of problems that end up getting folded into each other, but I think that's one of the crucial ones. And the way the Molinists try to solve that problem is by basically postulating in God what they call middle knowledge, which is a peculiar term, and I don't know how short of pricey this is supposed to be. but the idea of middle knowledge is roughly this, that God from eternity, you know, independently of any will to create or anything like that, has knowledge of every individual creature that he can make, every individual free creature that he could create, including those that he doesn't, and he knows them as individuals, and he knows what they would freely choose to do in any given fully specified situation that they could find themselves in. So how does God know, you know, what I'm going to eat for breakfast tomorrow morning? He knows that because from eternity, he has known me as an individual before I existed, before he willed to create me. He's known me. And part of knowing me fully as an individual includes knowing what I would do in a very specific, in any perfectly specified situation where that I could find myself in. And so God knows then what happens in creation because he knows which creatures he creates and he knows what situations he's arranged for them to be in. And so that gives him his knowledge of what we're doing, what we freely choose to do. And that also allows him to have you exercise this meticulous providence, right? Before he created the world, he could arrange things. He could arrange the whole course of human history because he knew all the human agents that were going to be driving the course of that history, and he knew what they would choose in the situations that he chose to place them in. But and this is sort of the key insight, I think, of Molinism, is that it's leveraging the distinction between knowing infallibly and causing with necessity, right? So when we, let me think of a good example. You know, if you think of, if I see a student in class, I can say I have infallible knowledge or as close to infallible as a human can have. I guess I could be hallucinating or something, but setting that aside, right? I have infallible certain knowledge of that student's choice to come to class that day. But the fact that my knowledge of that is not, the fact that it is certain and the fact that it is as close to infallible as human knowledge can be does not mean that I causally necessitated that student's coming to class. And so what Molinism is doing is it's taking that distinction and trying to work it as hard as it can and say, you know, God just has this knowledge of his creatures, and because he has that knowledge, therefore he can not only know what we do, but he can also arrange what we do. But through the whole thing, he's not imposing necessity on us. He's simply knowing and arranging. And then you can kick it up to the level of grace and some of the theological things that have to be maintained. But for the initial precy, I think that's probably more than adequate. Or not. Let me know.
Well, I think that's very good. So middle knowledge, if I recall, is called such because it's conceptually between or in the middle of God's simple knowledge or knowledge of simple intelligence and God's knowledge of vision, which had been traditional logical categories for talking about God's knowledge or the difference between God's knowledge of himself and therefore of all the things he could do, which is all possible things, and his knowledge of all real right. things. So this falls somewhere in between them. Involving the free will of creatures. But as you say, this middle knowledge is knowledge that God has of what creatures would do in any particular circumstances, but it's prior to his own exercise of his own free will.
Yes.
So it really is, it's an ingenious logical development in one sense, because it does allow for a greater subtlety in the discussion about predestination. And it does try to preserve, like Banez and Molina both do, God's sovereignty, because God is still free in creating this particular world with these particular circumstances. So that goes back right. to that commonality, that both sides are trying to preserve both the divine sovereignty and human free will.
Precisely.
But you know, as I mentioned at the beginning, good and evil are not on equal ground in this discussion. God must have at root responsibility for all good that occurs, but he cannot be held responsible for evil that occurs. So the way in which good and evil are explained has to be different. And so it seems that Molina is, if I can say this correctly, and please push back if I'm wrong about this, it seems that Molina is more concerned about divine innocence, or more concerned about avoiding God's responsibility for evil, and with preserving the freedom of the human will. Would that be correct?
I think that's a typical way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to concede that he actually, you know, succeeds in safeguarding God's innocence better than Báñez. But I think that's the usual characterization, is that one errs towards the side of human freedom, and that Báñez errs toward, Molina does, and Báñez errs towards the side of divine sovereignty.
Right.
So Taylor, how would the Báñezian position protect divine innocence, or guarantee that God is not responsible for evil?
Yeah. The big objection in regard to that particular topic with Báñez and Gregory Lagrange and John of St. Thomas and whatever, all these great Dominican Thomistic commentators, do they fall under the condemnations that the Church has made against John Calvin and against Jansenism? Do they fall under the condemnations of double predestination? And Báñez, Garrigou, John of St. Thomas, whomever, Cajetan, they all stress the great dissimilarity between predestination, grace, things that are the effects of God causing creatures to cooperate with him and to cause good actions, to be the causes, creaturely causes of good actions in the world. That system, if you want to put it that way, is not the same as the system regarding sin and reprobation and damnation. So Calvin, I mean, will explicitly say that it's the same, that God predestines some to heaven and that God predestines some to hell, that God moves the will of the saints to do well, and that God moves the will of the sinners to be vicious. Báñez, St. Thomas, etc., say that is not true, that all creatures receive grace which is sufficient to do good, and all creatures receive grace which is sufficient to be saved, but that some place a defect in regard to grace, and freely choose to resist that grace, and thus sin is only merited or demerited, if you will, on by the creature. So God has no causal influence at all when it comes to sin, right? It's merely a lack of goodness that should be in the act, which would be received by grace if the creature did not place a defect. Now, of course, the issue is that God also has to permit that defect. Otherwise, we're stuck with God being really and truly frustrated by creatures, like God really and truly trying to bring about the incarnation, but then, you know, Mary ends up saying no or something, and then God is sort of, oh, blast, you know, I've got to figure out a different way to get this done. So it has to be permitted, but God does not at all influence or cause sin.
I think that's a really important point. Calvin rejects the distinction between God's positive will and God's permissive will. It's a view of divine sovereignty, which is different from the Catholic view. I think Catholicism holds to a different way in which God positively wills things that do occur and permits defects in things that occur. And yet somehow in all of this, God is sovereign. So both sides, I think, would have to maintain that God could save more people than are actually saved, though he wills all to be saved. Perhaps both of you could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean that's the fundamental mystery of predestination. You know, if God has it within His power to save everybody or anybody whom He chooses, if he somehow is capable, whatever the mechanism is, of getting people to do what He wants them to do, of getting them to cooperate with His grace, then why does anyone not? And why does He not exercise that, right? You know, and you have the same problem. You know, Christ says, you know, woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida. If the works done in you had been, done in Sodom, they would have long ago repented in sackcloth and ashes, right? Well, if Christ knew that, if God knew that all along, why didn't He do those works for those cities that ended up getting destroyed, right? And this is the fundamental mystery of predestination. And I don't know how much we can add to that. You know, I think that really has to be left where it is.
Yeah, and I think that's important to acknowledge that, you know, theology is faith seeking understanding. And this side of the beatific vision, there are some things we will not be able to explain adequately. We can always go deeper, and we can perhaps come to a fuller understanding over time, but there will remain some mystery. And neither Molinism nor Bonesianism is at root capable of giving a full flowchart or a logical step-by-step process explaining why God chooses to do what he does. So they're both trying to explain the interaction of grace and free will to a limited extent, but we should respect the limits of theology.
Yeah, I think that's one. This is another point at which there's significant overlap between these two positions. There really aren't that many, in my opinion, there really aren't that many different theological doctrines or systems regarding how grace and predestination work with human freedom. You've got Molinism, you've got Bonesianism, you've got some other sort of offshoots, congruism, etc. But you don't really find within the tradition this notion that God is impotent to save all. So we're left with this mystery. And so the real difference between these positions, I think, is how is it that God saves those who are saved? How is it that grace works on the soul without it infringing upon human freedom? So that's where the differences lie. But yeah, there are overlaps, right? These are not just the antithesis of each other.
Exactly. So we have to explore the relationship between grace and freedom. What image do we use to describe the interplay between grace and human freedom? You know, Taylor, you mentioned physical premotion. I'd say it's a physical sort of efficient causality image that God's grace is actually moving the human will to act. You know, someone like St. Augustine or his later followers, especially in the early modern period, might describe it as a pull of grace, an attraction of grace, rather than a push of grace, that grace becomes attractive to the human will, and the human will cooperates spontaneously and freely because it desires the good that it perceives in divine grace. I wonder, how would we characterize, or what image will we use to describe the relationship between grace and freedom in the Molinist position?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll throw out what I think represents the Molinist position, and then William can say whether I'm being fair or not. With Molina, he'll use this term that he calls simultaneous concurrence. So the image that's often given is of two men rowing a boat, where both men are causes of a joint effect, which is the boat moving forward, and their causes it's also called coordinated causes. They're coordinating together to bring about the effect, and there's a certain way in which, you know, although numbers, when we're talking about grace, percentages and numbers are a bit silly, but in a certain way, you know, when you've got two men rowing a boat, one of them is doing 50% of the work and the other one's doing 50% of the work. One's doing 60 and 40 or whatever. But they're acting together, but not sort of through each other, which is a difference, I think, with Banez's position. So you've got two causes that are acting together. Two men, you know, lifting a couch. One, they both have one end of the couch or something like that. I think that's a good position or a good metaphor, at least to start with.
Yeah, I mean, all metaphors limp. I won't. It's probably fine as a starting position. I think the key for Molina is that, you know, the major dividing point between them is that for Molina and for his school, grace is not intrinsically efficacious, whereas for the Thomists, it is intrinsically efficacious, or at least efficacious grace. And that's a major distinction, right? If we're going to get into the theology of grace here, you know, the church, the Catholic Church holds that God gives everyone, all adults at least, sufficient grace to be saved, but that he that beyond sufficient grace, there's also efficacious grace, which actually brings about the act for which it was given, and actually secures the free compliance of the human will to do the good or avoid the evil that that actual grace was given for. And so for Molina, intrinsically considered in themselves, sufficient, merely sufficient grace, that is to say, a grace that's sufficient to do the act, but doesn't actually result in the act, and efficacious grace, there's no intrinsic difference between them. They're the same thing. The difference between them comes from the human will, right? Does the human cooperate or doesn't the human cooperate? For the, you know, for sort of later, the later Molinist school, you know, sometimes called the Congress, and this actually became the official Jesuit position. I don't remember what year it was. But it was sort of mandated that this be taught by all or held by all the Jesuits. There is also an emphasis on the fact that when God grants an efficacious grace, he's granting it precisely insofar as through his foreknowledge, through his middle knowledge, he sees that this is going to be an efficacious grace. This is going to be a grace that will be freely cooperated with. So that's a major point of contention or divergence between the two. For the Thomists, you know, you can correct me, Taylor, if I'm not putting this quite right. But for the Thomists, the sufficient grace is one kind of thing. It gives the ability to do a good act, but by itself, it doesn't result in that act. Beyond that, sufficient grace is also required a further efficacious grace, which is a different kind of thing, and it is intrinsically efficacious, and it actually reduces that potency to do a good act that was granted by the sufficient grace to act, so that it actually becomes a free human act.
Yeah, that's right. Although there's one thing that, and you didn't say this, William, but I think that this is one thing that is misattributed to this more Dominican Thomistic position. The distinction between sufficient and efficacious grace is oftentimes talked about as if it's two different kinds of grace, as if God gives efficacious graces and then sometimes he gives sufficient graces. And as you mentioned, sufficient graces are really just potencies. So sufficient efficacious grace distinction is really just applying the act and potency distinction to grace. So every grace is efficacious. Every grace is efficacious for something. But an efficacious grace brings with it a potency towards further graces. So the stock example is that sort of contrition for one's sins brings with it the potency to confess your sins. So sufficient graces are mere sort of potencies built into, if you will, efficacious graces, graces which actual graces that are causing you to do something. Whether those potencies are reduced to act is a question of whether God moves you to then also perform those further actions. You know, the potencies have to be reduced to act, essentially.
So if I can jump in here, a commonality to both positions would be God wills the salvation of all and offers to all sufficient grace. The distinction, however, between sufficient and efficacious grace has to do with the cooperation of the free will. And that's where the relationship of grace and free will comes back. Is the fact that the will does not cooperate something that God knows through middle knowledge and his sovereignty is preserved in the fact that he created the creature in those circumstances, foreseeing that the creature would receive sufficient grace that does not become efficacious due to lack of cooperation? Or is the difference in the grace itself, in the fact that God offers to the creature a grace that becomes not only sufficient but also efficacious for salvation? So to use a classic example, do Judas and Peter receive exactly the same grace, and it's only the different circumstances in which they exist and the choice of their own will by itself that results in their different outcomes, or do they receive different amounts of help or different graces from God? Is that an accurate summary of the different positions?
Yeah, I think this sort of brings us to one of my major objections to the Molinist position, which is that Molina explicitly says that that God gives unequal graces to different individuals, which is agreed upon by both positions, but that with less grace, one individual can do more than one who receives more. So he says that it's possible that Peter received less grace, less goodness from God than Judas, but Peter made better use of it apart from divine causality. I think that position necessitates a kind of passivity in God in regard to the source of our goodness, that that what distinguishes us is, at least in some cases, is a better use of grace, which is not itself the effect of grace. So in a certain way, it seems to me that it's a transgression of St. Paul's question of, you know, his rhetorical question of, who do you distinguish yourself? For Molina, it really is possible to distinguish yourself, not entirely, but that you can distinguish yourself from another and make better use of grace than another, with that goodness of using grace well, not being at all attributable to God.
Well, to push back a little bit, it would be attributable to God in the sense that he chose to create you in the circumstances in which he knew you would make good use of the grace, and he could have created you in other circumstances.
Sure, but it's also causal.
It's also worth noticing that the graces aren't necessarily, it's not a linear scale of grace, right? They're different things that we can describe as actual grace, and different kinds of internal movements that we can describe as actual grace. So, with God, there's the issue of the circumstances and what circumstances did he create you, which Father just, mentioned. But then there's also the question of which specific graces did he choose to give you? And, he may well have chosen to give, Peter lesser in some measure of lesser graces, but graces that he knew Peter would freely cooperate with. He knew that those were the graces that Peter needed.
Right, but even
given, go ahead.
If you apply the same thing, though, which I think Molina does, to even the same, like, so let's apply the principle to the same sort of good. So let's say final perseverance. Is it possible that Peter could receive less grace toward his final perseverance than Judas, and yet Peter persevere finally and Judas not persevere finally? If the answer is yes, in regard to that one particular good, clearly everyone receives different amounts and different kinds of graces at different times, whatever. But if it's possible that towards one and the same good, someone can receive less grace and yet do better with it, then what is the source of the goodness of that cooperation? It can't possibly be God or the grace itself, because the distinction is not at all attributable to a difference in grace, in which case Peter really does distinguish himself, not entirely in the sense that in a complete Pelagian way, but that Peter is better disposed to work and cooperate with God's grace simply by being Peter. I think that is starting to posit something like a passivity in God regarding who finally perseveres and who doesn't. And in fact, God can sort of push more, give more effort, if you want to put it that way, in this very crude way, towards one individual, and then that fails. And the one that he sort of puts less grace, less effort into, succeeds. It leaves the nugget, the seed at the center of the soul, which accounts for the difference between virtue and vice, is left more primarily in the will of the creature and is cut off from the divine causality and God as the source of goodness, which seems to me to be actually ontologically impossible.
I don't want to nitpick. I would take issue with the example of final perseverance, because I think that that's, depending on what you mean by it, you know, the way I think of final perseverance, it's you know, something that's achieved through a whole series of salutary acts over the course of someone's life, as opposed to being, you know, one specific good. But, you know, changing the example is necessary to make your point. I know that the big weak point, one of the big weak points, okay, I think there are two major challenges against Molinism. And one of them is, I think, what you're coming at here, and that's that you know, Molinism seems to make God somehow passive. And I don't know that I have a good response to that. You know, I said at the beginning, you know, I don't want to be cornered as a Molinist. I don't consider myself a Molinist. I'm happy to give my thoughts on the question such as they are, but I'm more sympathetic to Molinism than I am to Bunyasianism. The thing is, you know, at the end of the day, my real retort comes down to making a positive attack on Thomism. I think, you know, whatever the weaknesses of Molinism are, I think that the weaknesses of Thomism are significantly greater. So hopefully at some point we're going to take the gloves off.
Go for it.
Are we ready to move in that? Can we move in that direction? Can I?
Well, I think we can. You know, one question I have for Taylor is, can efficacious grace be rejected or resisted by the human will?
Efficacious grace? It be rejected by the human will? In one sense, yes. The answer...
Efficacious?
Yes. If the question is, can it be, the answer is yes. If the question is, will it be, the answer is no.
And what accounts for the difference there?
Yeah, so... this is another place, I think, when you're getting into more of the nuts and the bolts of St. Thomas's doctrine on grace as opposed to John Calvin's, for example. For John Calvin, right, grace is irresistible, which necessarily means that it doesn't really leave any room for the possibility or the potential to have done otherwise. What St. Thomas says is that when God moves the will, God moves the will contingently, that is, in accord with human nature, which is necessarily volitional and free when making moral decisions. The way that God moves the will does not in any way mitigate the potencies and the potential to have done otherwise. And he goes into a whole kind of long explanation as to why that is, part of which is due to the fact that when God moves us by actual grace, he's moving us to particular good actions. And it's part of the nature of the human will that it's never irresistibly drawn to particular good actions. The will can only be irresistibly drawn by something which is universally good. In other words, universal perfect happiness, which can only be found in God. So any other good which is placed before us always by nature allows us to retain a potency to reject it. So St. Thomas says, efficacious grace is not irresistible, but it is infallible. That means what God wills will infallibly come about. Not irresistibly, but infallibly. Well, why is that? St. Thomas says, not because of anything in the grace or the motion itself, but on account of the one who gives the grace or gives the motion, that because of the simplicity and the omnipotence of the divine will, if it wills anything simply, it's incompatible with the supposition that God is doing it, that it not come about. So it seems like that distinction maybe isn't that helpful. Okay, irresistible versus infallible. But it actually makes all the difference in the world, right? I think. Again, to use a stock example, if you have a fire and if you have a grill and you never put a steak on it, that doesn't mean that it was inadequate to cook the steak. It could have cooked the steak, it just didn't do so. For Calvin, you know, the steak, the grill is actively made so that it would never, ever, and could never cook a steak, to use a kind of silly example. So, yeah.
So it sounds like in the case of efficacious grace, God bestows this grace knowing certainly that the creature will cooperate with it, even though the creature could have done otherwise.
That's right. And it's not precisely for the reason that actual grace, efficacious grace, doesn't just cause Peter to do X. It causes Peter to freely choose to do X. And again, here St. Thomas is really pulling from philosophy more than theology to a certain extent. This is simply the corollary of the notion that all the being that we have comes 100%, of course, from God. And the same thing goes with whatever act that we have, that whatever act that we have must ultimately come primarily and completely from God as source, because only God is pure act. So if you apply that same principle to grace, you get some of these consequences.
So to go back to our previous point, good and evil are not on equal footing. They are related as being and non-being, which are vastly different. So God is the source of all reality, all that is real, all that is being and good. And evil is a deformity and a defect. It is a kind of non-being, and so cannot be caused in the way that good is caused.
That's right. And to whatever extent that we can say that a defect is caused, it's caused only by the deficient creature who places an obstacle or a defect to the grace. God does not cause that defect within the creature.
Okay. First of all, I want to follow up on that and just make sure I've followed it, because I'm not sure I did. You're saying that efficacious grace is not irresistible.
Right.
But would you describe it as intrinsically efficacious?
It is intrinsically efficacious on account of the one who is giving the grace. It's not intrinsically efficacious according to the nature of the grace itself.
Isn't that what it means for it to be intrinsically efficacious, that it's efficacious from itself and not from something outside of itself?
Well, yeah, I mean, people sort of quabble about this definition, right? Because I think some people lose the distinction between something being irresistible and infallible. So efficacious grace will always bring about the effect which it is ordered towards, but according to the nature of the grace itself, it is not intrinsically efficacious. No. And in a certain way, from a Thomistic Banyasian position, one can affirm that it's the cooperation of the secondary cause, the creaturely cause, which makes the grace to be efficacious.
And you—that's not just you think that that's the opinion of the Thomist school. That's not your correction of it.
Right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, and St. Thomas says this fairly explicitly, I think, in the Summa, when he talks about how it would be impossible for any particular good to move the will of necessity. So if that's what we mean by intrinsic movement or grace, that it would move the will by necessity, the movement itself would be necessary. He says that could only apply if the creaturely will were to behold the universal good.
Right, right. But he's talking about goods there that attract the will. He's not talking about God's, you know, metaphysical... Well, physical premotions moving the will, right?
Right, but physical premotion is merely a movement towards some good, right? It's a movement towards
right.
some particular good.
But that movement is what the grace is.
Right.
That is the grace.
Right. So on accord of the mover, the grace is infallible. On accord of the nature of the movement itself, the movement is fallible. Well, yes, the movement is fallible and irresistible. Again, it comes down to the distinction between irresistible and infallible. That's the key distinction. In other words, the nature of the movement or the grace itself retains, allows the potencies to reject it to be maintained within the creaturely will.
Okay. I might come back to that.
Sure.
Can I pivot for a second?
Yeah.
Can we talk about sin?
Yes.
And how God, on the Thomist, the Bunyasian understanding, how does God concur in an act of sin, or how does God how does sin happen in this system?
Yeah. Well, sin is caused by a defect in the creature. And if you're asking for the divine relation, there's no causal relation. When the Thomistic commentators speak at more detail about it, they will say that the antecedent permission of sin is a sine qua non, but it's not at all causal. That's essentially the answer.
But it's my understanding that the Thomists hold that God doesn't deny efficacious grace until he encounters a defect. That's the way Nicolau put it in, what article was it?
Nicolau's a difficult case because he changes his position over the course of his life. Garrigou will say, for example, that the cause of the lack of efficacious grace towards some good is the defect placed by the creature. However, in order for the creature to cause that defect, it is, of course, true that there has to be an antecedent, ontologically antecedent, not temporal, but there has to be an ontologically antecedent permission. But the permission is not causal. It is a sine qua non. In other words, of course, without that permission, we would necessarily be talking about someone having the efficacious grace. But it's not causal in any way. It doesn't posit anything within the will, as in the case of Calvin, nor does it remove any power from the will, which makes it possible to have done the good act.
So this may be the flip side of the principle of predilection.
Yeah, that's right. It isn't that God loves the elect and then hates the reprobate in the sense of pushing them away, if you will. It's simply that God gratuitously elects some on account of his love and mercy and permits the free choices of those who remain, and the free choice of those who remain is that they choose vice, and they freely choose to reject God.
It, you know, the topic of predestination may be difficult for a lot of contemporary people culturally, because I think we tend to have a view which is not a traditionally Christian view, but a view that goodness and heaven, you know, even supernatural beatitude are the sort of default position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this idea that everyone automatically goes to heaven and that you have to sort of opt out of it through extremely grievous and gratuitous sin.
Yeah.
Whereas the traditionally Christian view is that, you know, God created the world good, but that through original sin, we lost the inheritance of that good. And that, you know, any grace that we receive, and certainly the grace of salvation and the life of heaven, are being rescued from something, that we're being elevated to a higher state or brought out of a fallen state. So when you start with a worldview that is centered on the fact that God rescues some, you know, we're led to be grateful for the fact that that anyone is saved.
Yeah, I think we have tended in recent times, at least popularly in our thought, to think about and to speak about the beatific vision as if it were sort of our natural end. As if, you know, as you're saying, all things the same, you know, this is pretty much owed to everyone. And it's a difficult, in a certain way, it is a difficult and... It's a difficult and something that needs to be contemplated, but it's true. At the end of the day, the tradition has always maintained that the beatific vision is not just, you know, a little bit beyond our natural end, but that it's radically, infinitely beyond, and thus it's completely gratuitous. It's not at all owed, such that not receiving it would give us some kind of justification for cursing God, which may indeed be, you know, whatever poor souls have chosen to reject God, that's probably the particular curse they use against him, is that I really was owed the beatific vision and this God has unjustly taken it from me.
The distinction that you drew between infallible and irresistible with respect to efficacious grace.
Yeah.
On what rests the infallibility of that efficacious grace?
The nature of the one, the nature of the mover, essentially.
Right, but I mean, if a mover is going to infallibly move something, doesn't that demand that the movement be infallible?
It demands that it be infallible but not resistible, yeah.
But I mean, if it... How is there a distinction between those two? If it's going to be infallible, mm-hmm. if I'm going to infallibly, if anyone's going to infallibly move something, doesn't that mean that the movement that I'm imparting is, you know, the movement between the mover and the moved, mm-hmm. doesn't that have to be irresistible on the part of the moved if it's going to infallibly result in the motion?
Yeah, I don't think so. But this is a pretty, I mean, I think it's a good objection. I don't think that it sort of cuts all the way, but it is a good objection. And this is essentially Father William Most's, his main objection to Banyasianism. I think that the objection is essentially the same objection that Aristotle brings up. He calls it the error of the Megarians or the Megarians. I forget if it's in I think it's in Metaphysics. The position essentially holds, I think, that there isn't really a distinction between act and potency. In other words, if something is in act in a certain way, that must necessarily mean that the potencies were never actually there. They were never actual possibilities. Whereas St. Thomas makes a distinction between two kinds of necessity. And he uses a number of different terms to make the same distinction. So I think maybe the most helpful one is he talks about the difference between the necessity of the consequence and the necessity of the consequent. The consequent of Peter accepting his martyrdom, for example, that movement, that actual grace which moved Peter to do that, retained the potency for Peter to have done otherwise, even though it's the case that Peter, on account of the movement, would never have done otherwise. But there's nothing within that notion of Peter accepting his martyrdom which negates the possibility for Peter to have chosen any number of other possibilities. So in other words, it's necessary only suppositionally. It's necessary only on the supposition that God moves Peter toward it. But that supposition doesn't cut to the very nature of the act, nor to the very nature of Peter, in such a way that it negates the possibilities. In a certain way, it's kind of like, I think, it's kind of like trying to understand time travel. Once you've done something in a certain way, it's according to the nature of time, it's impossible to go back and have done it otherwise. But that doesn't mean that in the moment of choice, you didn't truly have a whole slew of options in front of you.
The distinction between, you know, the necessity of supposition, or, you know, the necessity of the consequence and the consequent, the physical premotion is at least logically and ontologically prior to the free choice.
Right.
And it is, that is the thing that is being, that determines, with absolute certitude, what, you know, whether that potency gets reduced to act or not.
Well, I mean, I think right. That's an objection, but I St. Thomas says that God moves necessary things necessarily and contingent things contingently, and that this is possible to God because God is the very architect of a contingent free will in the first place. But see, the contingency there, the contingency of God moving a creature to freely choose X, you're correct in a certain way by saying that contingency doesn't go all the way up, if you will. It's not a contingency which produces a kind of contingency within God. And it seems like that's kind of what we want in a certain way, I think, by stating that objection. But then you're a little bit more towards the kind of Plantinga side of things, where you really require that God be contingent about the effects of this action, when really all that's required for the act to be free is that it be contingent in its nature in regard to the human will. But not the divine will. I mean, will isn't contingent upon anything, right?
My objection is that it seems that, okay, here, you know, to lay a few more cards on the table, I think that the Bayesian system is destructive of human freedom, because whether I choose X or whether I choose Y is entirely determined causally by an antecedent of my choice that is entirely outside of my power, right? When Aquinas talks about what free will is and why humans are responsible morally for our choices, he describes it in terms of our being able to choose this or that. He describes it in terms of our being master of our acts. But whether I'm given a premotion or not is not something that I'm master of. It's something that God's master of.
Right.
And so my concern is that I think that Bayesianism, I think the Thomists have rushed in where Aquinas feared to tread, so to speak. I think Aquinas leaves a big hole in his account, and I think that this hole was left quite deliberately.
I think if you read, I think to a certain extent I agree with that. I think when you read Prima Pars, questions 22 and 23, which deal with providence and predestination, the mode by which these things happen is left open to a certain amount of debate. But when you incorporate it with sections from the Summa about grace, when you incorporate it with sections from the Summa Contra Gentiles about motion, And when you incorporate it with certain aspects of De Veritate, it's a, then when you pull the whole corpus together, you start to see, I mean, St. Thomas uses the term motion and efficacious causality in regard to these things so often that when you put the quotes together, you start to see the edifice, and you can really see how Báñez hasn't done anything but put those quotes together and show the system that St. Thomas is kind of presupposing throughout the rest of his works. But let me ask you this in response to your objection. Would you then fundamentally disagree with St. Thomas's statement that it's possible for God to move contingent things contingently?
No. No, I don't disagree with that.
How then? What would that look like for God to move contingently?
I don't know.
Yeah.
He's God, right? He's transcendent. That's the thing. I don't have an answer to it.
Sure.
You know, on the other side of this, right? The Báñezians frequently point out that, you know, the Molinists have gone beyond Aquinas and posited things like middle knowledge that Aquinas doesn't know. And, you know, I'm happy to admit that. And again, I'm not defending Molina in particular. I recognize the problems that plague the Molinist system, and I haven't resolved them. But I think that the Báñezians go a little too far in claiming that they're just, you know, putting together what Aquinas already laid out, because, you know, look at something like Báñez's commentary on Prima Pars 14, Article 13. You know, Aquinas, and if you read, okay, so if you look at Aquinas, he specifically denies that God knows future contingent events, like free choices, in their causes. Or rather, he says that that doesn't exhaust his knowledge, right? Because knowing a future contingent and its causes very nearly by definition means that you have merely conjectural knowledge of it, right? And so he says, you can know something as causes, but that's merely conjectural. God knows them in themselves, right? He doesn't just have knowledge of them in their causes. But if you go to Báñez, when he's commenting on that same article, he bends over backwards to say that actually God's knowing these events in themselves is in fact knowing them in their causes, right? And that's a major, Thomistic thesis, is that God knows free acts in their causes, right? Because he knows the premotions that he's chosen to give.
Yep.
But, you know, at the very least, that seems like a significant embarrassment to the Thomists, because Aquinas specifically talks about God's knowledge of future contingents. He considers the possibility that his knowledge is rooted in his knowledge of those events' causes, and he says that's not the way that he has certain knowledge of them. So, you know, what I'm getting at here is that if Aquinas had something like the Báñezian system in mind, if he had put all those pieces together and he had this all in the back of his mind as he's writing all of this, then why is he, you know, in that place? You know, there are other places like this, but in these places where that's the obvious answer.
I think that it's undergirding the entire system. I mean, I could ask the same thing about why he doesn't mention Scientia Media or something.
And I grant the point.
Yeah.
I grant the point. I don't think that he has a system. I think that he's intentionally not. A system.
To shamelessly plug my book, the whole second chapter is my attempt at pulling out the sections of St. Thomas and putting them in order to show that I do think he maintains that position, but sort of leaving that aside for a certain moment, because I probably can't, you know, proof text Aquinas and prove that he maintains every single Báñezian point. I'm wondering if I can quote something about Molinism. Is it cheating if I quote from a text? The great Herbert McCabe has this line, and I think this is true. I think this is true, and it seems to me more and more true the more that I think about it. When he's talking about Molinism, he says, this is from his collection of essays called Faith Within Reason, and this particular essay is called On Evil and Omnipotence. And he sort of does a cursory go through Scientia Media and Molinism, and then he finishes with this line, which is somewhat pithy and I don't know, maybe a little incendiary, but I like it. So of this, meaning Molinism, I will say nothing at present, except that it seems to me to possess the unique merit of denying simultaneously both divine omnipotence and human freedom. And I think there's something to that. Obviously, there's been a million Banyesian Thomistic critiques of Molinism on the former point, that it does away with the divine omnipotence. But I'm wondering how it might be argued that God antecedently foreknowing that Peter would do X in a particular situation, and then placing Peter within that situation, the foreknowledge necessarily requires that God sees that Peter will do that in that situation, and he creates just such a universe in which Peter not only will do X, but will do X in such a way that does not permit the kind of claim that Banyes makes, that the potencies are retained to have done otherwise, but they're just never actualized. In this case, God already knows precisely what Peter will do, and so there isn't really any potencies that are left, because God has chosen just the particular circumstances which will bring about just what he wants, also infallibly, on account of his foreknowledge. But the potencies are gone. So no matter what now, the kind of universe that's created, Peter will always and forever have done X, but in such a way that it never could have been otherwise. Whereas on the Banyesian position, there's actually this very robust and real, ontologically real potency to have done otherwise. And I think that's an objection that the Thomists haven't sort of put to Molinism strongly enough. That not only does Molina, I think, obviously posit too much passivity in the divine omnipotence, but that the mode by which God actually providentially order things takes away the potencies which are necessary for human freedom.
Yeah, I that's a major problem with Molinism, and Gary Lagrange raises the same point against the same charge against Molinism, that it results necessarily in the determinism of the circumstances. And you know, I think you run into the same problem if you examine like the grounding issue, right? What does it mean? What is the matter of fact? What is the reality that God's knowing in scientia media? And if there is such a matter of fact, then how is freedom a thing, right?
Right.
And I think that that's what's underlying your thing. That's the first point. I admit that.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm not a Molinist. the second point that I would make, though, is that, I mean, I don't want to say it seems ironic, but I mean, the charge that you're making against the Molinists, that they're removing, you know, that there was no real potency for the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like with very little tweaking that that problem can be applied to the Thomist position as well, right? I mean, yes, of course the Thomists insist verbally that there's a potency there, and that, you know, you're saying, which maybe I'm mistaken about this, I did not think that this was the standard Thomistic position, but that even efficacious grace is resistible, although it, because of the cause, it never will be resisted. But it seems to me that if you take those claims seriously, if you take that idea of intrinsically efficacious grace seriously, you know, even with the caveats that you're adding, so far as I can tell, you still end up with the position that you have a potency that is only nominal or only verbal, rather than being real.
Well, if I am, I mean, this is another way that Thomas talks about it, but if I'm sitting and I'm sitting in this moment, in a certain way, it's necessary that I sit in this moment according to the supposition that I'm sitting, right? But in the combined sense, I still retained the potency to have done otherwise. And that potency is something real insofar as, for Aristotle, potencies aren't mere sort of conjectures, conceptual conjectures, but are really something ontologically present within that which is an act. So
My objection, though, is that it doesn't seem to me that the potency that the Thomists have carved out in their system and that they appeal to precisely to distinguish themselves from Calvinists is sufficient to sustain moral responsibility, and particularly moral responsibility for sin. So earlier you gave the example of a hot grill, and you said, you know, if you have a hot grill, but you never put steaks on it, that it's still true to say that that grill could have cooked the steaks, but it didn't because you never put them on. And, you know, I mean, in one sense, I guess, sure, that's trivially true, right? There was a real capacity in the grill to cook the steaks. But I think the key point is that although the grill was able to cook the steaks in one sense, in another sense, whether it cooked the steaks or not was completely outside of its control. What was necessary for that grill to actually cook the steaks was for someone to put the steaks on the grill. And that was something that the grill was completely incapable of securing for itself. It had no say whatsoever in whether the steaks were put on it or not. It was, you know, wholly passive. And so, you know, carrying that analogy over, on the Thomas system, the human will does good if and only if God gives us a physical premotion to a good act. And whether God gives us a physical premotion to that act or not is not something that it is in our power to determine, right? God determines that. God alone determines that. And if you try to, you know, sort of split the difference somehow and say, you know, create some little sphere in which the human will has true self-determination and is able to determine whether God grants premotion or not, independently of God granting some prior premotion, then we end up destroying the Thomas system and we end up, you know, introducing precisely the passivity in God that Thomas are so eager to avoid. And so I guess that would be, you know, sort of my closing thought is that, you know, it's not that I think Thomas are Calvinists. I recognize that you're not. But it's that I don't think that the Thomas can logically maintain all of the theses that they have committed themselves to.
Clearly, there is much more we could discuss on the important topic of predestination in this episode of Sed Contra, a podcast of the Sacra Doctrina Project. We have talked about the Bonesian and Molinist positions. If you have follow-up questions or you'd like to hear more on this topic, Taylor will give us the details on our new phone number where you can call in and ask questions.
Yeah, that number again is 319-382-0886.
To close out, a quotation from St. Paul in his letter to the Philippians, chapter 2. Paul says, "Work out your salvation in fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work." So thanks be to God, who wills all to be saved and to come to knowledge of the truth, for the grace and the truth offered to us in Jesus Christ. Thank you to Dr. William Diem and Dr. Taylor Patrick O'Neill. And thank you for listening to this episode of Sed Contra, a podcast of the Sacra Doctrina Project.